It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, this is a busy time of year for the Purple Martins of Wisconsin. We'll preview a festival that celebrates the unique migratory birds.
First, a controversial campus free speech bill passed in the state assembly yesterday. It would expel students that disrupt campus events at UW system schools.
That's not the only thing on the agenda. The legislature also took up bills that look at everything from pre-existing conditions for people seeking insurance to work permits for teens.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter, and she joins us now to give us a recap of some of the biggest stories from the assembly. Laurel, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Laura, let's start with this campus free speech bill, which cleared the assembly. Can you give us some background on this one?
Yeah, so this is a really big one. This is actually a bill that the Speaker of the State Assembly, Robin Voss, has said is one of the most important bills, in his opinion, that the legislature will take up this session. So what this bill would do is set new guidelines for free speech and expression on all UW system campuses. And it creates a system where individuals who are found guilty of disrupting the expressive rights of others on two occasions would be suspended and on three occasions expelled. And it sets all sorts of, you know, kind of logistical steps for that, you know, a hearing process, a disciplinary hearing, who oversees the hearing, things like that, and actually sets the language as well for how disrupting free speech is defined, which has been a real point of debate as this bill has moved through the process. The language right now says disruptive behavior is, quote, violent or other disorderly conduct that materially and substantially disrupts others. So that particular language has changed quite a bit since the bill was first introduced a couple months ago. It's gotten a little bit more specific and a little shorter. When the bill was first introduced, it was a rather long list of characteristics that somebody might have if they were disrupting another person's expression.
And Laurel, this bill grew out of Speaker Voss's feeling that conservative voices were underrepresented on college campuses. Is that right?
That's right. That's something that Speaker Voss has voiced some concern about for quite a while now. He actually made a list of different campus speakers a while ago and their political affiliation, and expressed concern that there weren't enough conservative speakers on campus. So he believes that this bill will help encourage more conservative speakers to come to campus, that they won't be driven off of campus by protesters or be, you know, made not able to speak, you know, booed off stage or disrupted in some way. That's what all supporters of this bill are saying, that it's really a free speech bill, that it encourages free speech, that it encourages a diversity of opinions on campuses. And they don't really believe that that diversity exists right now. They think that there's kind of a liberal bias on UW system campuses in terms of speakers and student speech.
And opponents have some free speech concerns. What do they say?
Well, they're concerned that this bill inhibits the free speech of the students that want to protest campus speakers. So they say the language in the bill, that language I referenced earlier about violent or other disorderly conduct, they're concerned that students won't really know what's okay and what's not okay. So what constitutes conduct that materially and substantially disrupts another person? They think that that's a little bit vague. Under the bill, anyone is able to report another person for being in violation if they believe them to be in violation of these tenets. So somebody gets two reports, they have to go before the disciplinary committee, they could be suspended. And then opponents are also saying, okay, they go through that process, then there could be a legal challenge saying that the student wasn't actually participating in disruptive behavior. So that could potentially embroil the university in some lawsuits and unpleasant and costly, they argue, things from there.
And has the UW system taken an official stance on this?
The UW system did testify in a hearing on the bill, I believe that was last month, and they said that they recognize that they need to work on bringing more diverse speakers to campus. That's something that they have set as a personal goal. Interestingly, the UW system had just recreated its own free speech policies and guidelines just a few years ago. So they referenced that. I don't believe when they testified, they either registered officially in support or against this particular bill, but they certainly did during testimony acknowledge that they wanted to foster a greater diversity of campus speakers.
And we're speaking with Laurel White right now, WPR State Capitol reporter, taking stock of the latest from the State Assembly. And Laurel, another measure was passed in the Assembly that would limit post-election recounts. So what was that one?
So this is a pretty big one in response to the presidential recount that we had in Wisconsin last year. Folks probably remember that Green Party candidate Jill Stein requested and paid for a presidential recount in Wisconsin. It was one of the few states that actually went through with a presidential recount. There were some simmering all over the country. And what this bill would do that passed the Assembly last night is limit who can request those recounts. So folks might again remember that Jill Stein actually came in fourth in Wisconsin's presidential election. She just got about 1% of the vote. So under these new rules, the only person that could request a recount would be the second place finisher, and the second place finisher that finished within 1% or less of the winner. So that would have, of course, if this proposal were in place last year, candidate Stein would not have been able to request or carry out that particular recount. And supporters of this measure say that it's to prevent unnecessary, I believe they've used the word frivolous a few times, recounts that really don't have a high likelihood of actually changing the outcome of an election in the end.
So what's your sense of just how much more difficult this would make it for candidates requesting that recount?
Well, it certainly limits who is capable of doing so. I mean, it's just that second place finisher and within that 1%. So it really closes that that window there, that eligibility window for the times that a recount could happen in Wisconsin. And it does have different language for, I believe, an election that has fewer than 4,000 votes cast. Kind of, you know, makes it equivalent for a smaller election and requesting a recount. So going forward, this has just passed the Assembly now. It still needs to go to the state Senate. If it does become law in Wisconsin, I believe we would, you know, be likely to see fewer recounts in the state because fewer elections would simply be eligible to have them.
And Laurel, another bill passed the Assembly that came as a surprise to some people, a bill that affects how people would be dealt with pre-existing conditions. And this happened, was it early this morning?
It did, yes. This was quite a surprise to everyone. So this happened at about, I believe, 1:15 this morning. So if I'm not making too much sense, that's my excuse. I was here until about 2 a.m. So
wow.
This wasn't on the calendar, actually. We were nearing the end of the session, and Democrats used a procedural move to pull a bill to the floor that actually addressed something different, that addressed lifetime coverage limits for insurance. And through another series of procedural moves, Republicans replaced that measure with this pre-existing condition language. And what they ended up passing this morning, is a law that says Wisconsin insurance companies or insurance companies that operate in Wisconsin can't exclude people from having coverage if they have pre-existing conditions. That can't be something that causes them to turn away potential customers.
And is this one that has some support in the Senate, or is this just sort of new legislation that people are going to have to get to know?
This is pretty new. I mean, it was not, again, on the calendar last night. So this isn't something that we, as Capitol reporters, have been tracking and asking the Senate Majority Leader where he stands on this, if he plans to take it up. This is something that is part of the federal healthcare negotiations right now. So this language about pre-existing conditions is in the House version of the repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act, the American Healthcare Act. And I believe we found out today that it is also in the Senate version of the replacement bill for healthcare. So this is something that Republicans on a federal level have really embraced. So we'll have to see if the state Senate here, which is, of course, controlled by Republicans in Wisconsin, is also on board.
And Laurel, quickly, there were some changes in a bill to work permits for 16 and 17-year-olds. What is the thinking behind that one?
So this is rolling back a rather old requirement. I believe it's 100 years old that parents had to sign off on work permits for 16 and 17-year-olds in Wisconsin. Republicans who supported this measure said that requiring that parental signature is just unnecessary. It's a barrier to employment for some teens who might not have a parent involved in their lives for whatever reason. Democrats were opposed to this bill. They said that it removes some safeguards against child labor. So that was a pretty lively and animated debate. But it did receive the signature, I believe, of Governor Walker yesterday. So,
and lastly, Laurel, before we let you go, some movement on a bill that would allow the hunting of woodchucks.
Yes, that one was a little bit lighter debate yesterday. So that passed the assembly and saw an entertaining moment when Representative Joel Clayfish declared that woodchucks are rather tasty.
Over the objections of a representative from Sun Prairie who celebrates woodchuck
Groundhog Day. Yeah, right. Jimmy the Groundhog. So that was a heated debate as well, just in a little bit different realm.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That was Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, joining us to talk about the campus free speech bill and other legislation that the state assembly passed this week.
A festival near Horicon Marsh this Saturday celebrates the Purple Martin and offers education and an up-close look at the migratory bird that spends a big part of its busy life here in Wisconsin.
Richard Nicolai joins us now. He's a retired DNR wildlife biologist. Dick, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Well, can you start by giving us Purple Martin 101? What do we need to know about Purple Martins?
Well, first of all, they're largest of all the swallows that we have here in Wisconsin. They're approximately between 6 and 8 inches overall in length, weigh about 2 ounces. The males are very purple in color, especially when the sun lights on them. The birds arrive generally in early April and stay here in Wisconsin until approximately early August, and then head back down to Brazil. Birds that do arrive here are committed to a particular colony that people put up housing for. And by the way, housing for the eastern population of purple martins is the sole home, so to speak, for purple martins. They don't any longer exist in natural cavities, especially here in Wisconsin.
Why is that? Why do they no longer have that sort of natural home in the state?
Well, we've actually converted over time. Native Americans started the process many hundreds of years ago, where they had gourds, and the birds were attracted to those. In particular, the birds kind of found a friendship, I guess, with humans, and because of that friendship, they kept on associating humans as being a safe haven, and so there's a predator protection, I guess, from the birds, as well as from humans at that point in time was for dried foods, such as fruits, nuts, berries, and vegetables, that the birds caught insects that were actually feeding on those commodities.
What's in particular happening with purple martins in Wisconsin right now at this time of year?
Well, purple martins are nesting here right now. They actually started nesting in the middle of May and progress basically through the month of June, laying eggs. The process for purple martins themselves takes about 16 days of incubation with another 28 days of feeding those young birds after they hatch, and then they attain flight out there. And that's part of what we want people to view and watch and listen, I guess, with all our senses.
We'll get more into what's happening at Martin Fest in just a bit, but you're a wildlife biologist. There's a lot of wildlife out there. What got you interested in purple martins in particular?
My grandfather When I was growing up on the farm, before I left the farm until about 5 years of age, my grandfather had a Purple Martin house, and he also had a pair of old-time boots that he tacked to the barn, which Purple Martins actually nested within. And so it kind of stayed with me with time, and as I went through basic school and whatever else along the way, I was always wanting Purple Martins, and now I have a banding permit that I band Purple Martins for the last 30-plus years, as well as a wildlife biologist. It was just a sideline of interest along the way.
You know how birds, they have, in a sense, they have their own character. Crows are very smart. Cowbirds are sort of brazen. Do Purple Martins have anything that they're known for? They look like they have, they've got some personality.
They do, and the personality is that they love to be by humans, and that's what's so attractive for people. They have a melodious type of sound early in the morning and throughout the day when they're approaching, and like I said, they just love being by humans, and so that association is just like an extended family out there.
Talking to Richard Nicolai, retired DNR wildlife biologist, about the Purple Martins of Wisconsin. The event Martin Fest is coming up this Saturday. We have a link on the Central Time Facebook page with info. What is happening this weekend at Martin Fest?
Well, at Martin Fest, what we're trying to do is involve both adults as well as kids. There's some interactive things with kids within the Nature Center at Marsh Haven. Near Waupun. For the adults, we have several talks, one of which I will be giving on ecology of Purple Martins, and then we're going to be talking about various types of Purple Martin housing, attracting techniques for Purple Martins, as well as preventing nest competition for Purple Martins themselves. In addition, we're going to try to talk a little bit about cold weather, its impacts, especially this year we've had many impacts already of the cold weather, including this past week. We will also have a silent auction along the way, and then in the afternoon, early there, I will be trying to capture some Purple Martins and then showing people, if the weather is appropriate out there, and showing people as well as kids what eggs or the nesting compartment looks like, as well as the young, as well as the adults, if I can capture some.
And what kind of challenges do Purple Martins face today?
Well, many. The one of which I kind of alluded to was when they arrive early in spring. This year they arrived, or at least our birds arrived, March 26th. And the day after, it was cold. It ended up snowing, and we ended up actually trying to save our birds by what I call feeding in order to be able to get them through an appropriate time out there. And actually this week, we also had to end up feeding our birds because temperatures, when they approach near 50 degrees, there's a lack of insects, and when you have wet weather combined with that, that's not a great combination.
And what role can people play in helping protect Purple Martins in Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, recognize the birds themselves. The population has been declining rapidly over the last 50 years, about 6+% over that time period, and over the last decade, it's been well over 7.5% per year of decline out there. So if they're going to be placed in a house, you need to monitor. There's a responsibility because these birds are dependent on housing out there for them. And the responsibility that we need out there is to ensure that no other birds nest in those houses other than Purple Martins. And what we advise from the Wisconsin Purple Martin Association is to monitor, if you can, the housing. So that means if you can lower a house vertically, do so. And that's what we encourage people to acquire if they can, or build so that you can raise and lower a house and be able to take care of martins, because there are predators such as English sparrows or European starlings that can cause death and usurp nest compartments of purple martins.
Where does somebody get a purple martin house?
You can buy them in stores. There, you can go through the internet to acquire some. There's various vendors across the Midwest here that sell them through catalogs, as well as some of the wild bird shops that are scattered throughout the state.
When's the best time to put up a purple martin house?
Best time to put up a purple martin house is what I call really in early spring. What one is trying to attract is what we call second-year birds, birds that were born last year for new colonies. And so those birds generally arrive around May 7th through 10th, and then they continue on arriving through the end of June. And so those are the birds that you're trying to attract. And in order to attract them, you make the house as if it was used when you put the house up. You can also put it up any time during the summer, because after the birds fledge or be able to fly, they're going to be looking at other opportunities to fly and stretch and scan for opportunities for 2018. And so basically, throughout the early spring and throughout the summer, if one has a current purple martin colony out there and you want to change housing, the best time to put up a new house is when the birds arrive out there, and as I said, early April. So you have the newer house along with the old house, and that way the birds be able to get acquainted with that.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to Richard Nicolai, retired DNR wildlife biologist. Martin Fest 2017 is this Saturday at Marsh Haven Nature Center. Find info on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, Juna's wedding season. We'll find out what's changed and what hasn't when it comes to paying for a wedding. This is Central Time.
June is traditionally wedding month, and while society is getting more equitable for women, there's at least one tradition that hasn't changed much over the decades. The family of the bride still pays more than the family of the groom, according to the 2017 Newlywed Report. These days, the couple themselves often pay a portion, but their families pay about two-thirds of the cost. Families of the bride pay 43% of that total, families of the groom just 24%. Same-sex couples tend to get married later and pay for the wedding themselves.
Stephanie Coons joins us now. She's Director of Research for the Council on Contemporary Families, and she's also the author of the book, Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Stephanie, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Well, Stephanie, where does this tradition of the bride's family paying for the wedding come from?
Well, by a long route, it really is kind of a continuation of the notion of the dowry, which reflects a particular kind of historical and social time when women were actually not considered very valuable, productive members of society. It's worth noting that in many societies where labor is extremely important, women were so important to their families that the grooms, when you wanted to take a woman away from her family of origin, you had to compensate her family with what was called bride price. Some people thought that you were paying for the bride, but no, in fact, you were paying her family something to compensate for taking away her valuable labor. But with the invention of the plow and male dominance and the inheritance mostly by men, women were not able to bring much wealth, and they weren't involved so much in the manual labor that made for wealth. And so there was a sense in which the dowry developed as a way of the woman's family giving the husband something to compensate for the fact that they were going to be supporting a woman who might be economically not as useful as the man. even though she did all of this domestic labor, she wouldn't bring in money, and so it was important for the bride's family to give her money. And I think that that has been, that it continued in the 19th century and the early 20th century, when in fact women did not have much access to education and to work, and were not considered equal breadwinners, didn't have the possibility to be equal breadwinners. So it made some sense then, I think, to think, well, the bride's family should pay for the wedding, because that was basically assuring her, that was kind of a modern version of the dowry. It was assuring her that she would have a man to support her. Didn't always work out in practice, but that's what it reflected, and that's why it does seem so odd today.
Well, right. I mean, you just described a tradition that goes back a long time with a very different social framework around it. Not at all the world we live in today, where most women work and go to college and earn a lot of the family income. So why hasn't the needle moved on this as much as we might think it would?
Well, you know, we're a little puzzled by that, because so much has changed within marriages. You know, men are doing three times as much housework and child care as they used to. It used to be that men were threatened when a wife earned more than they or had more education. That raised the risk of divorce. Now it does not. The happiest couples, the ones who report the best sex, the best marital satisfaction, are the ones who share breadwinning and child care equally. So all these changes are going on in practical life, but the symbolic things have not changed so much. It's still, for example, the man who proposes, even though most couples have lived together before they get married, and it's been really a discussion between them. You still get many, many young people who ask the prospective wife's parents, and sometimes even just the father, which is really retro, for permission to marry. And so these symbolic things are very, very hard to, they die out very late, I think. And I suspect it's complicated by the fact that, you know, we're still in transition. It's only in the last 40 years we've been really pushing for marriages that are egalitarian, where we expect the woman to take an interest in the outside world after she marries, and the man to take an interest in the domestic world and the family life. And yet, there's still that old fairy tale idea that the marriage is more important to the woman than the man, and that it's her day to shine. And so I think that the parents of the bride feel more pressure to put that kind of display on for her.
We're talking right now with Stephanie Kuntz about why the family of the bride still pays more for weddings than the family of the groom. Stephanie's director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families. And Stephanie, I want to tease out a little bit what you just said about this idea of the wedding being a fairy tale. And I've heard it described as, you know, the bride is kind of a princess for a day. On the day of her wedding, there are these lots of magazines devoted to glorious weddings. Is there still something there about that day being so special that it is worth so much to the woman that maybe doesn't have the same sort of meaning to the man?
Yes, and I think that that's a real shame, because actually when you look at who benefits from marriage, turns out that men benefit just as much as women, if not more. And in the long run, for example, after the death of a partner or a divorce, men do worse than women. They really depend upon their partner more. So it's kind of a shame that all of this emphasis is that how much the woman needs marriage when the man needs it equally. And, of course, some men are beginning to recognize that. But there's still this this tremendous cultural set of cultural tapes that we carry with us as women, that this is the day that you'll be the most radiant, you'll be the most beautiful, everybody will look at you. And that's all right in moderation if the two of you are planning to be. This is the day when we will be a partnership and we will show ourselves at our best and ask our friends and family to take an interest in our relationship, and it will all be a very nice day. But this notion that it's the highlight of a woman's life is unrealistic for most women. And for the women that it's realistic for, it's really a tragedy, because it's all downhill after that.
groom's families today, though. They do pitch in a bit, and sounds as though some wedding planners and others report that, you know, they groom's families might tend to pay for the rehearsal dinner and pay for the bar tab. So how do, for instance, contemporary couples figure out who pays for what?
Well, I think there's a lot more variation than actually shows up in these surveys by bridal planners and married, you know, bridal magazines and stuff, because those are getting the more traditionally minded people who are planning their wedding. In fact, what we've seen, just as we've seen this tremendous diversification of family life, of the types of marriages that people organize, of the way that they regard their marriage, the roles they play within their marriage, there's also a tremendous diversification of the actual decisions people make about getting married. And many, many couples do this off the radar, so to speak, you know, civil ceremonies or some universalist minister. And we don't, you know, they probably make these decisions in ways that are much less traditional and much more practical in terms of just, okay, who has the money here? What else do we want to spend it on? Maybe we want to have a potluck instead of a great big catered meal, or put the money down and save the money and put it down on a house down payment. So there's a lot of variation. And but I do think that, yes, cultural traditions die hard. They, you know, behave. What we've found is that behavior tends to change before the ideology around it changes. For example, one really good research finding is that people say, well, oh, we had a high divorce rate because there were all these newfangled ideas about divorce. No, once people were in marriages that were bad or had conflicts, that's when they began to think about that divorce maybe was a legitimate option. And I think that the same thing's happening here. We've just been experimenting over the last 30 or 40 years with the kind of marriage that is egalitarian and doesn't have these set etiquette rules that are defined by old-fashioned gender roles. And in practice, I think a lot of people are making decisions that are more practical, more flexible. But there's the, if you don't exactly know what to do, there's a template for you that still, I think, affects people's decision-making and emotional reaction to weddings.
Stephanie Kuhn stays with us right now. She's Director of Research for the Council on Contemporary Families and author of the book Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. And we're talking about why the family of the bride still pays more for weddings than the family of the groom.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've gotten married lately, how did you pay for it? Who paid for what? If your children have gotten married, how did you decide who paid for what? And are you getting more practical in your wedding planning, or is it a Disney princess extravaganza? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Stephanie Kuntz about why the family of the bride still pays more for weddings than the family of the groom. This is an old tradition. Lots of things in society have changed, but this is still a constant, more or less. Stephanie is Director of Research for the Council on Contemporary Families.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've gotten married recently or your children have, how did it get paid for? How did the tab get split up? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Monica with us first in Waukesha. Monica, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Your show made me remember something that I cherished a lot. My husband, my now husband, and I paid for our wedding completely. And he actually made more money than I did at that point. So you could say, since we didn't take a loan or anything, that he paid for it. But growing up, my father used to say half joking, half seriously, that the lucky guy was already going to take one of the big jewels of his house, that he wasn't paying one extra cent. And it warmed my heart every single time that I heard that. And thank you for that fun memory.
Oh, well, thank you for calling and sharing. It's a great memory and a great story of your father. And Stephanie, Monica ended up going halfsies with her husband. They paid for their own wedding. Is this something that's becoming more common. I think I read that particularly among couples later in life, this might be the case.
Yes, and with the age of marriage rising, and particularly rising for educated women who are now more likely to marry than less educated women, but they marry at a later age, they're also much more likely to be working and to be earning decent pay. So you've got a situation where you have two earners who have been out of their parents' household for a little while. And I think it's among those couples, it's becoming much more frequent that they will pay for their own wedding. They're able to, and their parents are getting ready to worry about retirement, so it's only fair. So, it varies tremendously. There are parents who have plenty of money or other young people who still, even though they're in their 30s, may have a lot of student debt. So families work this out. But I think that despite this ideology that really does bear down hard on families and puts a lot of pressure on them to follow the traditions, I think that things are getting more flexible.
Monica, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Ryan in Woodstock, Illinois. Ryan, hi.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good. What did you want to share?
My wife's in the wedding industry, and she releases white doves at weddings. Mm. And we typically get calls from groom's mothers to book these types of birds. And all the birds do return home. But a lot of times some hopeless romantic soon-to-be husbands want to do this as a surprise for their bride. So we kind of see a mix.
Interesting. So this is mostly, you see it originating from the groom's side of the family.
Yeah, I think there's definitely kind of a gift thought, from the groom when they want to do this. Sometimes they can symbolize, the bride and the groom and their journey out to the wild blue yonder. And other times they're remembering friends or families that can't be with them. So the symbolism is unique for each couple. But we a lot of times see the groom taking initiative and doing this for their bride.
Ryan, thanks a lot for calling and sharing that. I hadn't heard about doves before, but it seems to me that there might be some features of weddings, definitely like we were talking about before, that the groom's family might zero in on more. Have you heard about doves like this?
Well, I did know that sometimes doves were released. I didn't know it was that common. But, of course, what struck me about Ryan's comment was that it comes on top as an addition, a surprise on top of a wedding that might have been paid for by the bride's family. So I'm not sure how much how much that experience is reflecting a real change in the families. And it's great to hear all of these cool stories, though, from your callers.
Yeah, I didn't know the doves came back either. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much for calling. And let's go to Mike in Janesville, who's with us next. Mike, hello.
Hello. I have a kind of a slightly older wedding. We got married. I was 49. She was 48. She was 49. We had both had marriages before. My wife, for 24 years, asked for a divorce several years ago. And I'm not going to ask my parents to pay for my wedding now. They paid, my family did pay for part of the wedding back in the 90s, but we simply took out a zero-interest credit card, and my now wife made a bunch of the decorations and tried to keep the list low. It's still almost 200 people, and we probably spent $8,500, but it's on a credit card, and we're in this together. So we're just making payments on it, and it's going to be the two of us. I mean, you call it halfsies? I don't know.
Hmm. It sounds, yeah, pretty close to halfsies there, Mike. Thank you for sharing that. And that story from Mike, Stephanie, is that more typical of couples who it might be a second marriage?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think that even at a really older age as a first marriage, but particularly a second marriage, it appears that people are much more practical than about saying, well, we can pay for this ourselves. We should pay for it ourselves, especially if our parents helped out the first time.
Well, that's interesting, though. He said he's not going to ask his parents to pay again. He was, older, second marriage. But are there people who do ask their parents, and are there parents who will pay for the second go-round?
I'm not an expert on that, and I don't know, but
my own, my son's about to get married, and I think that I'll help out the first time around, and he better make a go of it or pay for the next one himself.
Stephanie Kuntz is with us right now. We're talking about who pays for what when it comes to weddings, and as it turns out, the bride's family still pays for more of that wedding than the groom's family, although the couple themselves also foots part of the bill typically today. Stephanie is Director of Research for the Council on Contemporary Families, and Sean is next from Beaver Dam. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I recently got married a couple years ago, still feels recent. And I would say I was, more of the typical, stereotypical, fresh out of college kind of marriage. And I think the point about using the, what wedding planners and stuff like that as a template, really that was kind of us. You know, we didn't have too strong of an idea of what we necessarily wanted to have, who pay what. But that template really kind of helped. And then, yeah, we were flexible and just kind of talked about it and see how we felt about it. But I think one thing that what kind of tends to leave the bride or the bride's side of the family paying more to some degree is how the bride and the bride's family oftentimes for these more stereotypical weddings just want more extravagant things. I mean, that can be part of the old stereotypes, but I think that kind of helps people say, maybe the bride's family should pay a touch more.
Sean, thanks a lot for those thoughts. And Stephanie, is there something to that, we were talking about this fairy tale day idea that the bride maybe wants to spend more on the wedding and therefore maybe it makes sense for the bride's family and the bride's side to pay a little more?
Yeah, no, absolutely. None of these stereotypes are come because people have, bad intentions in these things. And it's always more complicated than either just straight out, old-fashioned ideas. On one hand, there is this notion that it's the expectation of the bride's family that many grooms and grooms' families have. But the other side is absolutely true, that many women do want a fancier wedding and their families are more likely to push for more of the extravagant things. And when that happens, I think that's only fair that as couples talk through these things, they're going to have to be negotiating the rest of their lives. And one thing to be negotiated is, how much do we want to spend on this? And if one really wants to spend more than the other, one family does, maybe that family should kick in a little more.
And Stephanie, we've got about a minute left, but I want to ask you, what can families do, do you think, to initiate a different kind of financial arrangement beyond the traditional bride's family pays more for weddings? Do you have any ideas?
Well, I think the most important thing is to, to make sure that the two people who are getting married talk about what they want and talk honestly with their parents about what the possibilities for help are. And I think the parents should, especially if there are financial questions involved, be absolutely honest about what it is that they feel that they would like to contribute and what it is that they think is an unfair expectation. They also, I think, need to keep bringing the young people back to the fact that this is just the first day of the marriage. It's not the be-all and end-all. And there's a lot of research that shows that when people focus too much on having the best wedding ever, that is not necessarily any help at all to the rest of their married life, and in fact, it may sometimes detract from it.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us again.
It's my pleasure to talk. I love your show.
Oh, thanks so much. That was Stephanie Kuntz, Director of Research for the Council on Contemporary Families, talking about why the bride's family still pays for more of that wedding than the groom's family.
Do you ever get hungry enough to where you feel ticked off, angry, or hangry? There's science about that. We just spotted a new article about the science behind hanger.
And among other things, when you're hungry, your blood glucose levels drop, and your brain needs that glucose to do a lot of stuff, like to concentrate and to perform even simple tasks.
And here's the key. Lower blood glucose can make it, quote, more difficult to behave within societal norms, end quote. So you might snap at somebody.
So one solution, eat that meal, have a snack, but ideally not a sugary junk food snack. That can prop you up in the short run, but then it can lead later to a glucose crash and hence more hanger.
That may be where I go wrong. That, you know, if I'm needing that snack, I will often reach for that sweet junk food. Even if I don't need a snack, I tend to do that too.
The Central Time team herds off, like, you know, water buffalo to those donuts.
But I am always the model of societal norms and good behavior and never snap at my colleagues and coworkers. Right, Veronica?
I will not comment on that. I'll stay politically correct and say, of course, Rob, you're perfect.
In the interest of science, more donuts at the workplace. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.